This week's podcast is an interview with Sir Tim Berners-Lee, the inventor of the web. I caught up with Tim at the Web 2.0 conference in San Francisco. In this interview, Tim looks back to the early days of the web and looks forward to what's next. Enjoy.
This is the Killer Innovations Podcast with Phil McKinney. Keep in mind that the information and opinions expressed in this podcast are Phil's and Phil's alone, and they don't necessarily reflect those of his past, current, or future employers. Now, here's Phil McKinney.
So, Tim, we're here at the Web 2.0 conference. Lots of changes happening, but let's take a little step back to the work that you did that actually started this whole groundswell with the invention of the web and HTML. So think back to your CERN days. What was going through your head as far as what was really the trigger that resulted in the invention that you came up with?
I think it's not really a particular, one particular trigger. It was a mounting frustration that the web didn't exist. And, having to deal with all these different networks, different computers, different programs, different documentation formats, when trying to just have a life as a software engineer within a huge organization. It just made me think more and more about how the world could be better.
Right. So, you did the project, you came up with the original work. Any indication on how widespread that was going to be? I mean, you think back to that time and you look at where the web influences on everybody's lives today, and the number of people it touches. Any indication? Did you have any kind of an inkling back then on the impact?
I did call it the World Wide Web, but it was also very clear that it shouldn't be for just one narrow sort of discipline or one narrow application. But then, obviously, there was no indication that it would go on taking off. The load on the first web server just went up by a factor of 10 every year for 3 years in an absolutely solid exponential. So that, you could, when you put it on a log graph paper, you could put a ruler through it. So that was a sort of gave an indication that this is very serious. This is, that was not an S curve. But all the time, there are so many things, which they look off. They have this exponential takeoff, and then they falter and they stall and they collapse. And that's right. The normal curve for most things.
Correct.
And most of the things I'd done, they had their day and then they'd falter and they collapsed. So there were so many ways, and there still are, quite a lot of them are still exist, the ways in which the web could have faltered. And so it was just constant work trying to figure out which was the most important thing to do tomorrow to make sure that it kept on going as one open web.
So what were the key things that you think were the catalyst that allowed it to keep on the curve? I mean, the involvement that you have on W3C and kind of being that leader as far as kind of keeping the standardization activities under control, is it what were kind of those key ingredients?
Well, I think first of all, remember the internet has been really well designed as an open platform, and I just used that. The internet has spread across American universities, so it had this. It was a petri dish, all set ready for the mold to be dropped onto it. So credit to the people who designed the internet to not design it for a particular application, but to design it as an open platform. We've tried to copy that with the web. And so as the web's taken off, yes, I think the spirit of the way people have joined in, I think there were a few critical points. There were points at which it looked as though it was going to be dominated by a particular company. And there were points at which it looked as though patents would be a huge issue. And so the point when all the large companies got together and realized that the web technology had to be royalty-free was crucial. Mm-hmm. And so and once that was set up as being the rule of how the consortium worked, and the rule basically for these open standards on the internet that make the web work, then I think it became much more solid.
It seems to be the challenge always with the industry standards, right? You get kind of that small group who wants to control it, who wants to figure out a way to make the money on it versus kind of the open, give it away freely, royalty free to try to encourage that, that growth. So what was the process of trying to get everybody to kind of align on that thinking? Because it was, like you said, it was such a crucial stage.
I think there was a big battle between people with the different coming from the different camps. And in some large companies, of course, in the consortium, we're trying to reverse engineer what's happening inside these companies. But it looks as though they would have typically a separate division that reported separately to the CEO that just made money by suing people who have used their patents. You know, going and digging up patents, right? You know, they were exclusively legal rather than technical. They dig up patents, trying to figure out who they could sue, and that brought in a certain amount of money, and it paid for itself. And that was, you know, that was part of that. That was a business model. Meanwhile, you'd have people in the engineering division who wanted to produce a new product. Somebody who wanted to do web on mobile phones or something, and for the web on phones to take off, that was going to be a huge market. It was, and the revenue which was going to come, even a small part of that market, was going to absolutely dwarf the income from trying to get royalties from patents. But when you try to get the royalties from the patents, it destroys the market. So I think what happened was it got to the point where it was being discussed in the Wall Street Journal. And then it got then at CEO level, it was realized that really it had to be a company-wide shift in policy. And so these large companies made significant decisions. And you could see it from outside. The engineers came out to the meetings looking relieved, because they knew that they'd be able to go on working on internet.
They could actually go on inventing versus worried about the attorney, the legal guys.
Suddenly the lid was off the box again, and everything was possible.
So now you fast forward. You're here at the Web 2.0. So what are you talking about here? What's the new thing that's got you excited?
Well, there's so many things happening at once. When you have something as broad as Web 2.0, you know, so looking across, there's things as straightforward, if you like, apparently straightforward, such as HTML5 evolution, which of course is not straightforward because there is no specification on the planet, it seems, which has got so many people who want to say what they're, you know, which have got ideas and serious constraints on how it should evolve. So the evolution of HTML5, but maybe under the radar of HTML5 evolution is the fact that the web applications platform is maturing into a very serious distributed computing platform. And behind that are all the questions about how you do security and trust in this. So web applications, there's some web applications work buried in HTML5, but also there's web applications working happening in the web apps working group and other working groups. Things like being able to find out where you are on the planet, being able to access the local attributes of the local devices, the local storage, local swappable screens, local cameras, all sorts of things. Those will make it really, really going in a new direction. There's that. I mean, there's data on the web, which is exciting and a big push there.
So one of the things that you've also been evangelizing for quite some time is this notion of the semantic web. So can you give me, you know, some people may not be familiar with the context. That would be people hear the term, but can you give kind of maybe a 2 or 3 minute, you know, your view on semantic web and what the value from that activity will be on people's lives?
Semantic web is a fancy term for putting data on the web, putting it on properly using standards. We call it linked data because when you put it on with the semantic web standards, you can take something which you've got sitting typically in an Excel or a CSV file. When it sits there in a CSV file, you can load it into a spreadsheet, and you can look at it and you can print it out, and you can graph it. But a computer can't really figure it out because very often your CSV file has got little notes around the edges and all kinds of decoration. It's not obvious what it means. And so when you export that as a semantic web file, then you change it in a little ways. You put export the same data, but it means that now each row of the spreadsheet or whatever it represents, a car, a product, for example, it gets the URL. It gets the URL for the concept. That's different. It's moving from where the web is, we think of as a web of pages about things, to where your actual product or you as a person gets the URL. When that happens, then you can ask the system data-like questions about it. You can do queries on it. So instead of searching for things and just dropping into somewhere, when you found something with the semantic web, then you can treat all the data in the world, in principle, as one great big database, which is very powerful.
Right. So what's been the roadblock? Because, I mean, the semantic web concept has been worked on for a number of years, and you see pockets of it. But is there a roadblock that's preventing it from taking off?
It is taking off. Right. And the linked open data world is taking off in really interesting ways. We can talk about some of that. The reason why I think it didn't happen, first of all, we didn't put forward the data layer, which is the simple layer, as linked data. What we first did was to design quite complicated languages for designing ontology, well, quite powerful languages like OWL language, which is more powerful than a lot of people need. We designed that before we had the query language. Now, if you can imagine trying to promote relational databases without SQL,
that's a little tough to do.
It's not going to happen. So now we've got Sparkle.
Right.
Sparkle is like SQL, but it queries systematic web stores, and it's a protocol, so it goes across the internet. So now we've got that. Really, we've got RDF, we've got OWL, we've got everything you need to put stuff on the web and to aggregate it and to search it. And if you have once you have a Sparkle endpoint, that will return you. You can pick what query you want to do, and then you can get XML back to use in any XML application. You can get typically JSON back and CSV files even back for you to use in your spreadsheets again. There are also a lot of ways you can go once you've got it into that linked data form.
Right. So that's what you're working on. What if you had to look out a little bit to the future? Where do you think this is all going? I mean, what do you think the web looks like in 2 to 3 years?
Just tag on to that a little bit about linked data. This year, 2009, has been for me a year of just particularly focusing on pushing government data onto the web, and that's something which has created quite a sort of snowball of interest. Both, of course, and it's coincided with an interest in government. In the US, the Obama administration has been very positive about being open, putting all that government data out there. And then this government data has got a lot of value to industry.
Mm-hmm.
If you're working in the US, then having government data available is actually going to make life easier. And I think that the UK government's realized that as well. And there's been a personal push from Gordon Brown to get data out there, to be more transparent. A lot of people in the UK, bipartisan way, are calling for more transparency and putting data out there. So that's the big stimulus to the whole linked open data movement.
So in that case, then, it's really about the innovators of the future really are now going to have this wealth of data that's going to be much more usable for them and whatever innovations that they're going to drive. That becomes really almost kind of a component piece to help drive some of these new innovations.
Yes, I think that you'll just be working at a higher level.
Right.
Just as now, if you're working on an essay for school and you need to look up about the capital of a state and what it's, you can look it up on Wikipedia and you can find out what the population is. But if you're writing an application in the future, and you've got the idea of a city, you'll take it for granted that you'll just be able to look up its population as though it's as a property of that object,
if you like.
Just as a simple query, you'll just assume that all that basic data about how the country works and what state it's in is going to be available, and that will really change the way you design any application that'll have this backup data behind it to ground it, give it much more power.
So I see it from a standpoint from an external use. Do you see enterprises thinking about using this as part of kind of their internal data source? Because I'm thinking about all the data that you just look at a typical corporation gets locked up in all these disparate databases and spreadsheets.
It is amazing. In fact, I thought that it was going to be disparate databases, but a lot of them, in a lot of cases, it's the spreadsheets. That's amazing.
You'd be amazed at how many businesses run on spreadsheet.
Yeah, and they go to a huge amount of effort, and it's manual. With the spreadsheets, it's manual effort.
Yes,
it's manual effort to take the spreadsheets from all the people representing, who run different groups, and bring them up to the department level and produce a summary spreadsheet, and then to put that in, to put the send that up to the boss.
So and ultimately, it gets them to put into a PowerPoint.
And eventually, it'll end up in a PowerPoint, and nobody will be able to click through and say, "Where'd you get that from?" Really? No. What was that like in 2006? Can I compare that with 2007? Can I compare that with our competitor? I'd like to graph that against the NASDAQ.
Right.
No. Over time. These are the things that typically, if you could do that, you'd want to be able to do. And yes, when you talk to the CIOs often about sharing data with outside the company with their suppliers, which is a very good thing to do, of course, to make the whole supply chain more efficient, then, and you say, look, aren't you in the situation where you have this, aren't you a stovepipe, aren't you a silo of information, and don't your partners want to be able to see inside your company, to see a little bit about what's in store for them in terms of orders and that sort of thing? And he says, look, don't talk to me about silos. I know about silos. We've got them all inside, right? They're in a big company. Yeah, you need this data integration technology. This decentralized data integration technology inside the company a lot. I think that, so my guess is it's going to happen inside the companies first, and then bit by bit, there will be this competitive syndrome like we saw with the web.
Mm-hmm.
No, initially none of the bookshops had a web.
So. Right.
Okay, then so then one of them did. And then, but they didn't put the catalog of books on there because that was proprietary information until somebody did. And then they put the, then once the catalog of books was on the web, then all the bookshops had to, but they didn't put prices on until somebody did.
Right.
But they didn't put stock levels on until somebody did. And now, to be competitive, if you're selling books, you've got to have the whole thing. You've got to come clean with whether or not you've got the thing in stock. And then, and so life works much more efficiently because that data is available. But it's still available, you know, it's available when you go to the website and order a book. I can't pull that into a spreadsheet. So I think that it's, we'll get the same sort of syndrome of competitive incremental disclosure.
Mm-hmm.
To be competitive, you're going to have to give me that stuff using, you know, as a feed.
So it sounds like when you think about kind of the executives who are leading, let's say, you know, corporations, but also government leaders, there's a new skill set that has to be almost ingrained in the DNA in those people, because today they don't think about data in that context. They think of it as the traditional spreadsheet, roll it up, give it to the PowerPoint. So what do you think, when you think about the executive of the future thinking about how they manage, whether it be a city, a country, or a corporation, what should they be thinking about? What do you think they should be aware of or conscious of? Because a lot of executives you talk to have no, other than they know how to go to a URL to find a page.
I think the mindset, which they've eventually, and it took a few years, but they got for the web, that they don't get for data yet, is the unexpected reuse. You know, when you put something on the web that you put it on, you know, for a friend, or you put it on there for a colleague, but all kinds of other people will, by the end of the year, all kinds of people would have used that information. They'll be pointed to it, there'll be links to it from all kinds of places. People will use it for different reasons than the reasons you put it on. And people might end up, as a result, you know, buying your products for reasons that you didn't expect. And that's all good. That's all good news. When you put data up, it's the same, and in a way, in a more powerful way, because when you put data up, people can join it with stuff which is in other databases. They can compare it with stuff from other companies, but also they can compare it with stuff from a different domain, and suddenly, so that the value of the data suddenly increases. And that's why putting stuff on the web is a good idea, because it just increases the value of each piece of information, mm-hmm. making it. People need to get that about data. And you know, thinking, instead of thinking of a spreadsheet as something I make and something I mail to somebody, thinking of it as something that I put on the web and I update every now and again, and it's a feed, which other people then become part of an information flow. And I'm part of this information flow, and I'm providing value, and I'm making my company more efficient, more valuable by making that data reliable and up-to-date and usable for all kinds of things.
It's one of the things that I get pulled into is how do we bring technology, for instance, to emerging markets? And my argument is it's not about technology in emerging markets. It's about getting those citizens of the emerging markets access. It's not about the device. It's about getting them bandwidth and getting them access to the information. So what I know you've got kind of a interest and passion on how do you bring the web to kind of into the emerging markets where people haven't had access before. So what are some of the things you're thinking about and working on in that space?
This is all a huge area, of course. We're just launching the World Wide Web Foundation, and it's very exciting. It's fascinating to look at, when you look at the world and realize that we've been operating with the 20, 25% of the people that use the web, and then the rest of the vast majority of the web don't use the web at all. Although quite a lot of them have signal. So we wonder, don't they have a device? Does their device not work? Do they have a device and a browser, but does the browser not work? Or does the website not work for them? I think there are lots of questions we can ask. Have we designed the web really for Silicon Valley? You know, was it designed by the early adopters, for the early adopters? How would it need to be different? How do you need to reprogram it so it's going to work for somebody in rural Africa? It's been really interesting to go out and have a look at how people are using mm-hmm. the internet in rural Africa. We've got more visits to come. We've got, I think, a huge amount of learning to come. But I think I'd agree with your passion that people have to be. For me, it's the creativity I want to see
right.
from them. They have to participate. They have to be involved. So it's not just being able to browse the web. It's having a web server. It's not just reading people's blog. It's blogging. It's not just being able to look up a map. It's when you find that your village ain't on the map, going in there and fixing it so that it is. So a couple of us were out there in with a BBC trip with a trying to see how people are using it and trying to persuade a couple of people. Look, you know, when you go to Wikipedia and you find Ghana, you find it's, Ghana is in Wikipedia, but then you go down, you find that really there's not very much information about the districts. That actually you can change that. When you go to OpenStreetMap and you find that some of the roads you know about aren't there, you can change that.
Right.
So I think it's a very important attitude that for, actually for, I think, for everybody, people in the developed world are getting that, with certainly with blogs and wikis, but I think even in the developed world, we still have to make the web very much more of a creative space, very much more a collaborative space, so that we're really building ourselves a combined web of all of our shared common knowledge and our shared common hopes and aspirations.
So talk about, so what is the foundation's real objective? What's the purpose of the foundation right now?
Well, generally put, it's to make sure that the web serves humanity to its utmost, as best as it can. And that means, in fact, various things. It means clearly the standards which the World Web Consortium has been doing for 15 years are still important, so that we're making sure that those work well is part of it. Doing what we're calling web science, looking at the web, it's a huge thing. It's got 10 to the power of 11 web pages, and it's got really interesting structures, and nobody really is analyzing it. So that's getting people, getting academics to look at the web and not only analyze it, but also think about how we could engineer it better. Mm-hmm. But then the third piece of it is looking at how we can how it can be tweaked, how it can be made better for the people who don't have it at the moment. And that tends to, so, and it's not just people in rural Africa, it's people in the cities. It's not just people who don't have the right character set, it's people who are illiterate and can't read or write at all, but can handle audio and video. So now there may be places where making the web very much more of a video web is going to be really exciting as the bandwidth comes up. It's such a huge open question that there are just enormous challenges there, and it's a very exciting time.
Yeah, it is. You think about what's happening now with the web, with kind of you're seeing this, if you read some of the reports on the, the amount of content and data going across, and its shift being heavily towards audio and video, as an example. What's your take on that, given just the shift from what used to be text-based pages to now the role of audio and video in that overall experience?
Well, I think on one side, yeah, it's great if you can get something in video. Well, it's even better in HD. And later we'll say it's better in stereo, and then we'll say it's better in full 3D immersive. And the bandwidth will go up and up and up, but then our compression technologies will get better and better. So there'll always be people pushing the edge for that immersive experience. On the other hand, it's amazing what people do with 140 characters. when you download your bank statements, that's not a lot of bits. It's a lot of power. When you download a calendar, when you share a calendar, then it's not a lot of bits you're using. So a lot of the really interesting functional things, my sharing my trip and my flights,
yep,
very small number of bits, really useful for all the people that know me to be able to figure out where I am and remind me that I ought to go to the gate now. So I think that we shouldn't worry about about the internet getting swamped. There will be applications which will always push the boundaries on it. But the good news will mean that if we're cabling up for HD video on demand and HD bidirectional video conferencing, for example, then everything else will be at the cost per bit of doing all these other things. We'll get lost in the noise.
To wrap up here, one question I wanted to have you think about and answer was we're here today. You're sitting in the probably the best chair of anybody in the industry to kind of see where the future holds. What do you think the web looks like in 2 to 3 years? I'd go 10 years, but I think that would be kind of pushing the envelope. But what do you think the next
two to three years? In fact, it's amazing how sometimes it seems to change very fast, and sometimes it doesn't. So we talked about web applications. Mm-hmm. So I think that's going to become really valuable. There may be markets for web applications, just like you have markets for phone apps now. You maybe have people building all kinds of little web applications that will work together if we can get the trust models right.
Mm-hmm.
the amount of computing which will be kicking around on people's desktops and things will be interesting, because they'll get more and more powerful processors for when they want to handle graphics and compression and so on. So as a result, you'll be able to do all kinds of things with data analysis in distributed fashion. So I think we're surely exciting. So there's maybe even all the browsers will actually implement scalable vector graphics, which will be a wonderful little step. Now we're looking at a few years like that. I think the move to the web of data mm-hmm. is happening. That will have some spin-offs of applications that nobody's imagined yet, because the way you can combine data in ways you can't combine text. What I'd like to see, and I hope will happen in the future, is that we get a resurgence of the interest in PubSub, in notifications, streaming, real-time updates of things. There were people have been looking at that every now and again, about trying to using protocols like HTTP or Jabber to send off streams of information about what's changed, allowing me to, for example, to do a Sparkle query and then say to the Sparkle server, okay, you've given me a list of people with that criteria, tell me if it changes from now on. And then, so the world then becomes a set of interconnected streams of novelty.
Mm-hmm.
And for people, it's always been what's new. Now, the what's new page has always been the most interesting thing on a website. And I think we'll find also for machines, after a while, they'll sort of learn all the basic data, and the machines also will be making money out of what's new. And so the protocols for sending what's new will be important.
Interesting. Well, Tim, I thank you for your time, and appreciate you spending a few minutes with me.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
This series of interviews with innovation thought leaders is made possible by support from thenextbench.com. For more information on the series and to listen to the previous episodes, visit thenextbench.com.
Thanks for listening to this week's podcast. Please send your feedback. Particularly, I'm interested in hearing your thoughts on doing these kinds of interviews. The objective is to give you a broader exposure to others that are out there creating killer innovations. If you found this podcast interesting and you want to connect with other innovators, join the network. There's killer innovation groups now in existence over on LinkedIn and Facebook and a variety of the social sites. Also, feel free to follow me over on Twitter. Just do a follow, Phil McKinney. Also, pay it forward. For those of you that are regular listeners of the podcast, you know that my sole objective in the podcast is to pay it forward as a return to my early mentors. And when I asked them how to pay it back, they told me later in my career to pay it forward to others. All I ask is that you pay it forward. Thanks for the time out of your busy schedule. Look forward to talking to you real soon. Bye-bye.